right, boys and girls, the year was 2006. It was fergalicious out there. Everyone was dancing and singing that song. Amy Winehouse was also still alive and singing about rehab, which was, you know, I didn't really know that she needed to go. Mm-hmm. I thought it was just a catchy hook to a song. You know, and the reason I'm talking about 2006 and my favorite, actually another show I watched was Heroes. That came out in 2006. And the first season was amazing, and then it just really fell off. Mm. But we're bringing this year up because we're talking about a movie that came out that year, and that movie is The Devil Wears Prada.
Yes.
Yes.
Pre-stock market crash. The housing bubble just burst. Fashion was still thriving, but it was collapsing because of fast fashion.
Wow. Yeah. Hey, you may have heard a strange new voice on mic number three, and that's because in studio today, we've got the one, the only, Blair Dawson.
Hello.
Yes. And as always, I'm Gabe Pacheco, and joining me, per usual, is the one, the only,
Sammy Hamarne. Per usual.
And we're here today for another episode of Eat, Pray, Judge. And you brought up a term that I had never heard before. What is fast fashion?
I was just going to ask the same
thing. Okay, fast fashion, let's see. It's, think H&M, think Forever 21. It's fashion or like Brandy Melville, where you walk in and every week there's something new. It's poorly made, very disposable, and it's just based on trend.
So like Urban Outfitters, does that fit that mold?
Yes. Urban Outfitters would be considered fast fashion, but really think of clothes that's not like a staple and it's not meant to last you a lifetime.
Like American Apparel.
Yes. Okay. American Apparel went bankrupt.
Oh, okay.
But just think like...
I think H&M, really, that's what I'm thinking.
It's the epitome of fast fashion.
Boom. Got it. I need a dress shirt. It's got to last me four wears.
Yes.
I got a job.
You wash it, it's gone.
Yeah. It's minimum wage, but I've got a dress in business cash.
Small children have made it.
Nimble fingers.
Yes.
Yes. Not a high thread count.
No. Cool. No. It's, it's not... Like, I'd say, okay, so fast fashion, you could say, like, the root of it is through streetwear. Streetwear started in the 60s. Think, like, Bill Cunningham, the fashion photographer, where, like, you know, fashion used to be dictated to the people, and then people started creating style through, like, ready-to-wear instead of, like, couture or going to, like, a tailor or, like, having things made. So, yeah, just, like, streetwear became a thing in the 60s and started to evolve.
It's, like, it's the taste of the people.
Yes.
So maybe fashionistas would go and take photos of people on the street and be like, look at how they flipped that denim jacket and made it look cool, even though it wasn't a brand name denim jacket.
Now it's the inverse. It's the people dictate style, whereas before it used to be the industry dictated what people wore.
Yes. Okay, I get it. So the tastemakers were at the top of the pyramid, and they were the CEOs of the company, and they're saying this is what everybody's going to wear this season.
Well, there was that whole... not the case. So the whole dialogue in the movie where Meryl Streep's talking about the color she chose for her sweater.
Cerulean. Like
how, yeah, exactly. And how it trickled down fashion. How it basically happened that they actually picked that color for her. She just didn't know.
Which still is true in a way, where it's like there are the few people that like dictate. You know, there's also, I have like a history in fashion. And so I used to take like, when I was in high, I grew up in New York and I would take classes at FIT and Parsons when I was in high school. And when I took like a fashion merchandising course, and there is like millions of dollars invested in trend forecasting. So there are all these fast fashion brands that essentially just like pick like, oh, this is the color this season. And then it's basically, you just see it in terms of what people are wearing.
Yeah.
Because it's what is available in these mass consumer stores.
Yeah, I think about, so like a personal anecdote, when I travel abroad and I like to sit at a cafe and take notes on what everybody from that country is wearing. And then the next day I'll go to a vintage store and purchase an outfit that looks exactly like the most normcore outfit of that country. And then buy a pair of the blandest shoes possible so that I can walk around without looking like an American. Because the easiest way to tell if somebody's, what country somebody's from is the shoes they're wearing.
Mm-hmm.
But then also it's like, oh, well, I won't get mugged and like no one will pay attention to me if I just have on like the drabbest clothes. Mm-hmm.
You can look like the most basic bitch, but if you have nice shoes and a good haircut, you can get by.
That's all. Yeah. That. Well, how can you tell if somebody's really rich? They just have a nice watch on and like a white t-shirt.
And you don't even need the watch. It's really the shoes and the haircut.
Right. You're like, oh, their teeth are white.
Yeah. You can wear something very plain, but if it's like well made and it's a staple,
yeah,
then you're chic.
Yeah. Yeah. You're Soho minimal.
French style is very much just like layering and having very nice basics.
Can I tell you, can I go back to 2006 for a minute?
Yes.
Because Blair and Sammy, I want to know where everybody was, what everybody was doing. You know, I was watching TV and I was just paying attention to Dick Cheney like, shooting people in the face.
Mm,
shotgun blast.
Accidentally.
Accidentally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Remember that when vice presidents would just accidentally shoot people?
Yeah.
I was in middle school. I wasn't watching the news cycle.
He was, I think, well, if you didn't know, Dick Cheney was out there duck hunting.
Right.
And he
shot someone in the ass. Right?
Was it the
That's
ass?
The story?
It was in the face.
Oh, in the face, I thought. Yeah, it was like he was hunting turkey or some weird game bird where they have like the little pellets that shoot out of the gun and he hit his friend in the face.
Yeah, his hunting pal, or Harry, ass, Harry Whittington.
Mm.
Yeah, no, that's, but that, you know, and still gun control wasn't passed.
I wonder why.
Mm-hmm. So that I just found that to be a fun, embarrassing thing. And and then as and another sort of terrible Republican controversy that came out that year was there was a Florida congressman named Mark Foley who got in trouble for drunk texting and trying to seduce all of the male pages that worked for him.
Ugh, the good old days.
Surprise.
And this was, I guess, before people kept receipts, fam, or mm-hmm. like were worried about that, because he clearly, I mean, I would never text anybody that I was harassing, mm-hmm. you know? You don't want to leave a paper trail.
Yeah, I feel like, yeah, sex scandals pre-Me Too definitely were treated differently.
Yeah, yeah, well.
It was more about moral outrage as opposed to, like, yeah, you know, you're doing women wrong or sexual assault.
Yeah, this guy, he immediately resigned and he blamed his texting, his lewd texting on a drinking problem
mm-hmm.
and the fact that a predatory priest molested him when he was younger.
That's good. Shift the blame.
Yeah, taking no responsibility for himself and trying to find a way out by pointing.
Well, now I have empathy for him. I'm sorry.
We don't even know if that happened, though, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the thing. That's definitely a thing to say if you're a monster.
Mm-hmm.
Blame somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
That's a
sick
story.
But, you know, well, Pat Fields, she designed the movie, costume designer, famous costume designer, for most famous for designing Sex in the City.
Yeah.
And so we were talking about Sally and... Or no, not Sally, Patricia Field.
Yeah.
She was very important to me because she was like my role model at the time where I was like, oh, I realize that, you know, I initially thought I wanted to work in fashion.
And this was in middle school.
This was in middle school. And it was, you know, kind of like the way I dressed and everything was kind of like... I was very, like, affirmed for that and just the way I styled things.
What was your vibe? Ascots or?
Not, like, a lot of wild prints and thigh-high socks and Doc Martens, you know, and I grew up in a very preppy town, so that was, like, very different. But, yeah, so I just, like, thought that I was going to go into fashion, but then I just, like... I didn't really like the environment of fashion from what I knew of it.
And what were your primary sources for what you perceive fashion to be?
Well, I mean, in middle school it was different, but when I started taking classes at FIT and Parsons, it just became very clear to me how amoral the industry is, especially with how awful it is for the environment, but mostly, I don't want to say slave labor, but let's go ahead and say slave labor, child labor.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what brand you're wearing, right? Like, whether it's Rocawear.
Yeah, or, look at where it's made, and yes. That'll tell you all you need to know.
Yeah, if it says made in China.
Yeah.
No bueno.
Yeah. Unethical labor. And also it's just like it's a very toxic industry, which the movie captured very well. I'd say it's a lot like the comedy community, but if, if the comedy community were feminine and type A.
Yes.
And actually, I'd say the comedy community now is like a little nicer, but I'd say the New York comedy community like 8 years ago, you know, really just like outwardly mean and cutthroat.
Sure, sure.
Even more competitive. I think like...
You think comedy's more supportive now in New York City?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what would be some changes? Just like, you think it's like a cultural change in the zeitgeist, or is it technology that's made us nicer? Is it...
I think it's just the people that have come in, like Joe Pera and Dan LaCosta. You know, I think it's just...
Great guys.
Yeah, I think from what I've heard of the previous community, people would just tell each other to kill themselves and that they gotta quit. And,
dope. Yeah.
You know, chill stuff like that. And
yeah, well, I like that you just mass text people to kill themselves.
Right. Yeah.
Kind of like a Mark Foley, only instead of trying to pick up people. Younger comics, just text them, quit, kill yourself.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so the fashion industry is very much like, you know, no one's saving face. Everyone's telling you if you suck or you did a bad job. You know, I worked in costume design. I mean, I don't want to jump ahead, but like I did work in costume design for a while, and people would always tell me like, you're too nice, you got to get out of this. So I like relate a lot to the Andy character.
Wow. So costume design, what was that like? Was this for movies or for theater or?
Movie, theater, TV here in New York. And it is a lot like, I'd say my experience at FIT Parsons and then going to art school myself for undergrad for costume design, my costume professor was a lot like the Miranda Priestly character. And all of the jobs that I had straight out of college were a lot like the job in the movie.
Nice. Well, let's hop into this movie, The Devil Wears Prada. Okay, it was my first time seeing this.
What'd you think?
I'll give it a rating at the end, but I will tell you now that there were I was riveted. There was I was not expecting to pay as much attention as I did. Like, I didn't have to pause the movie halfway through. I didn't see it when it came out because I didn't think it was for me.
And honestly, that I'm just gonna go ahead and say it. Okay, misogyny, just because it's a feminine topic doesn't mean that it's not a universal story.
That's,
you know?
Right. Well, I don't think it was marketed to me as well.
Right.
So, you know, as much as we can say that something is misogynist, it is also the way that
well, it's a female protagonist in a feminine world.
Yes.
I think for me it was the reason I didn't see it is because I had zero interest in fashion or like a movie about fashion, I think would be. I mean, maybe that's some sort of underlying misogyny, but I don't...
Right, am I not supposed to go see a war movie because I don't like war, you know?
Yeah.
Just because it's like of a different world.
Now, there's a hip-hop fashion movie that I did watch recently, which was a documentary on like the emergence of street culture brands.
Mm-hmm.
So like FUBU and Anissi and all... And Aniche?
Is that how you pronounce it? I always just read E-Nice.
Yeah. So, you know, you are right. Like, I have watched movies about fashion before. But for, you know, yeah, like, I wasn't maybe familiar with the oeuvre of Anne Hathaway. Mm-hmm. She wasn't like on my radar.
I think it was the best performances I've ever seen from Anne Hathaway, Emily Blunt, Stanley Tucci, and Meryl Streep. I think this is their best role.
So let's hop. You named like a stellar cast, and I want to agree with you on all of these points. So Anne Hathaway, I saw in like my least favorite Batman film. Mm-hmm. So she was Catwoman in that, and I was like, yeah, she's good in this, but like I'm never gonna watch that movie again. So this was the first time I saw her in a lead role, and I enjoyed it. And then Stanley Tucci, killing it.
Yes.
In every line he had in this was sizzling.
Him and Emily Blunt are the best comedic actors.
I watched Emily Blunt in this, and I know her and love her from Sicario, mm-hmm. right? She was dope in that movie, and she's also in A Quiet Place, which is another fun horror movie.
I never saw it.
But in Sicario, she says very little. Her performance is totally understated, and she comes off as a serious...
She has range.
...action star. And then in this... She could be in SNL. She seems like an SNL player in this. And I wrote in my notes, her facial expressions at every moment are killer.
And a lot of it is improvised. You can tell the dialogue.
Yeah. And she's got this British accent in this. I guess that's her authentic voice.
Yeah.
But she sounds like one of the mean people Bullocks. from Game of Thrones. Like yeah. She sounds like she could be like Ramsay's Very sister posh. Or something.
Yeah, she. I think she was. I don't know if she won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for this film, but I know she was definitely nominated.
Yeah,
you know this film was like nominated for a lot of Oscars that year.
Yeah, and but she was only up as like what is it when you're not the star, when you're not the lead,
best supporting,
and it's like man, no, but she steals every scene she's in.
It's incredible, Meryl Streep too. I mean. Just the subtlety and just how much they change. And oh my God, I really do think it's some of the best comedy writing or the best comedy screenplay.
Yeah, I think Anne Hathaway wasn't the first choice to be the lead in this. And then I was watching with Amber and she said Hathaway's playing like a similar character that she played before because she's already made a movie
Princess
about...
Princess Diaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's already made the movie about upgrading... Mm-hmm. Or like changing.
It's her best role.
What, Princess Diaries?
Those two movies are the best acting jobs that I think she's ever done.
Yeah.
Kind of like downtrodden. I have to prove myself.
Mm-hmm. I never think she's good or bad necessarily in movies. I just feel like I can always tell she's acting.
Okay.
So whereas like.
She doesn't disappear.
Right. Whereas, you know, I mean, the exact opposite of that would be Meryl Streep. Where yeah. Like, you actually don't even think about her. You just.
Such an incredible character actor.
Yeah, I mean, she's...
Her in Big Little Lies, like, oh my goodness.
She's a revelation in this movie.
Yeah.
Based off of, or loosely based off of, they say, but almost directly based off of Anna Wintour, who was the editor in Vogue and is sort of like an autocrat as far as the fashion industry was concerned.
I mean, the movie is based on a book
for someone that worked for her, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't, what little I know about fashion... I know who Anna Wintour is, and mm-hmm. I've heard stories. After working on the Upper East Side for several years, like you hear a lot of things. This was taken basically by one of her assistants.
This is very much a real story. Yeah. It might be like a little heightened, but absolutely. When I worked in costumes, and you know, you work with fashion as well, doing costumes for movies, mm-hmm. and just what is most true is how it's ripe for comedy because it's such an absurd world.
Right.
From the outside, but everyone who's in it is very serious.
Right.
And when I was working in it, just everybody does act like they're treating cancer. And and honestly, it's like the expectation is to do the impossible. And if you can't do the impossible, you're a disappointment. And why are you here? There are 1,000 people that could fill this job.
I love that that line that comes up over and over and over again. And by love it, I mean I loathe it. It makes me feel, every time I hear it, it's like nails grating on a chalkboard. Like, there are millions of people who would kill to have
And it's
your
true.
Place.
That's why creative fields are so exploitative, because it's like, well, if you're not going to deliver the impossible, there are a bunch of people behind you who will.
And they also say millions of girls, specifically girls, which is a demeaning
Right
of
out of college. Yeah. I mean, those burnout jobs are... I mean, I stopped working in costume design for that reason, is because it's like, it is super exploitative and abusive. And I was working like 80-hour weeks for taking home like $500 a week. And I didn't have any like relationships outside of work. And, you know, it's not possible to have a life outside of work.
You are the first world sweatshop kid for the fashion industry when you're right out of college.
True.
And you're the young interns, you're the disposable, in quotes, girls.
Right. And, you know, they're all people that come from like middle class or upper middle class backgrounds and stuff like that. And, you know, clearly in the movie, she's like, oh, you turned down Stanford Law to go be a journalist. And like, that is very much the people that work in these fields, you know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it is, they also have to like hire people that have families that support them because they don't pay them enough.
Right.
Well, this is also the case on Capitol Hill.
Like, yeah.
You look at any affluent field or field of power, there's always this intern or apprentice or
You have to work for free for so long.
And you can't do that unless there's someone at home supporting you. So all of these power continues to replicate itself by creating these internships. Or low-wage jobs where you need to have high skill or high information levels.
Yeah.
Or you just need to start on the ground floor eating shit for a while.
Yeah, you have to be highly educated and be able to just kind of like float
for a
while.
And young, because your ability or tolerance to be able to take that much abuse kind of dies at 30.
When you get right out of college, you just assume, well, this is the workforce.
This is not what life is like. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
You don't have class consciousness yet. You don't care about unions yet. You don't worry about your health or health care.
Just finish your thought.
No, I was just thinking that because you're young, you don't know anything. And even the New York City Teaching Fellows, like I joined that. And I think about like Teach for America and the Teaching Fellows kind of now as an older person, as like a sort of union busting institutions that are there to undermine the teachers' unions, and like, because you're taking people who are idealistic and young and full of energy and you're burning them out quickly, you know, but you're able to exploit them because they have the stamina and don't know any better yet.
Exactly. Yeah. There were so many times I was treated poorly, and where if there was an HR, I would report them, but I also had no idea who I would tell things to. Like, even when I was an intern on a TV show and I was 21, someone was like sexually harassing me, and I told an adult on the set, and he was like, I don't know. And so I'm just like, well, I guess I'm just gonna hide from this person until the job is done.
Yeah, that's a safe work environment.
And the thing about HR that people don't realize is that HR's job is to protect the company,
correct,
not to protect the employee. So even though they're telling you out of one side of their mouth come to them, that's a union rep is really the person that will protect you, because their job is to advocate for the workers.
And when you're young, you're not in a union anyways.
Right.
HR knows where their bread gets buttered.
Also, it's like for all these creative fields, it's like it's no surprise that they're often, you know, restaurant industry, any creative field, that's where young women are exploited the most, because it's like, as you can see, like in the movie, you're just battered and battered and battered, and everyone is so mean to you that the only people who are nice to you are like these grown men that are trying to fuck you. So it's and so it's just like, oh, well, I guess like I'm just going to have this person lick my wounds, but also you're a fucking creep. But also, I mean, you're so nice to me.
Yeah, thanks, Daddy.
That's, I immediately thought about like Senate Pages when I was watching this, as far as like her level, her entry level. Like that's the first thing. And also like French kitchens, like those militaristic French kitchens where like, you're berated and have like dishes thrown at you.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like that sort of environment.
Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah.
It made me think of Zero Dark 30, where you'll have the CIA black site interrogators torturing someone for like 24 hours straight, and then they turn off the heavy metal for 2 minutes, and then the nice interrogator comes in and hands you a Coca-Cola.
Just gives you a hug.
No, for sure.
And that's the guy, the one person.
It depicted that quite well.
Yeah. Who they throw you one little biscuit, you know, and you're like, oh,
you're
finally
helping
someone
me.
Sees me.
Yeah. Oh, and like, oh, the earnest, the plucky Northwestern journalist, let me help you.
Oh, man, we can talk about him for a second. So before we go any further, this movie is about Anne Hathaway playing a wonderful, precocious college graduate from Northwestern University who has dreams of becoming a journalist. She decides to work at Runway Magazine for a year underneath Miranda Presley, who's played by the one and the only
Meryl
Streep. And so Meryl Streep, though, playing Miranda Presley, is a tyrant. She's like the Saddam Hussein of fashion, you know, and I don't, but she's,
but you have empathy for her.
She's excellent at her job. And I think one question this movie poses is, do you have to be nice if you're excellent?
Well, it's also, there is like, I mean, it does play with gender dynamics really well, because it's like, well, if Miranda was a man, she probably wouldn't have been divorced by multiple husbands. Mm-hmm. She probably would have had just like a dutiful wife if she were a man. And, you know, Annie, Anne Hathaway, Andrea, she does discuss that in the movie. Like, it is addressed where it's just like, well, she's just very good at her job and no one would question it otherwise if she weren't a woman.
Yes. So there is, right. I don't want to present Miranda Presley as an evil force, but she is the antagonist in the story, in that she is the primary obstacle to Anne Hathaway's joy and happiness.
Yes, for sure. She is the antagonist.
Yeah. Yeah. And so presented as
lovable
that,
antagonist.
She's also this is a good piece of art because she's presented by both the writer and by the actress.
Yeah.
Or actor as a three-dimensional character. Yeah.
So. Yeah. I think it really, the movie really addresses well where it, like, the world doesn't owe you shit, you better deliver. And it's like, the world doesn't have compassion for you. Like, what, you want to be kissed on the forehead because you did a good job? Like, I also think it addresses, like, what happens when really privileged people enter these spaces and, like, expect, like, to get a gold star for just doing your job.
Yes.
But then it's just like, no, you delivered, and then we keep moving.
right.
I love the Stanley Tucci character for that reason.
Yeah, the best the you pep do, talk. If you do a good job, you should be invisible.
Yeah.
Is part of it.
Yes.
You know, who care? Like, I'm not here to praise you.
Yeah.
You know, and we're making money. The whole point of this thing.
Multi-billion-dollar industry.
It's all about capital. So
you are a cog in this machine. You are not a human.
And,
which is not necessarily right, but it is the way it is.
Right. And they're always under a deadline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's crunch time. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's the case on a movie set as well.
You're, yes,
like, okay, we have a schedule.
Millions of dollars on the line. And it's like, you do have to make the impossible happen, because if you don't, then we lose so much money.
So when we first get into this workplace, let's talk about this movie a little bit. Like I love the opening scene.
Oh my God, the opening sequence is one of the best film opening sequences that have, because it, okay, so Anne Hathaway, she's very like normcore, very, you know, basic. She's getting ready for the day. She's getting an onion bagel. And then they're also watching the fashion women get ready for the day, where they're counting their almonds and they're wearing their like very beautiful like lingerie, and like they're very chic and glamorous. So they establish character by contrast.
Yes.
And
this is a tremendous montage.
Yeah.
And I have to say, when I saw it, I watched it three times.
It's so beautiful.
You know, I didn't watch the movie three times, but I did stop it after the montage because I was taking notes.
Great soundtrack, too.
And the first time I saw it, I just thought, wow, women have to work so hard in the morning to get ready. That was all I thought. It all washed over me. And
yeah.
Then it was only the second time I watched it where I was like, oh, Annie is different than these other ladies.
Wow.
Because at first I was like, and this is my whatever. But it was like, oh, it's all the same. But
well,
it's not all the same.
It's like establishing the absurdity of the fashion world.
Right.
But it's kind of like, this is what Annie is like, and here's what she's entering into.
Yeah, the one thing I liked about, like, the only time I noticed the difference between her and them, possibly because New York, Manhattan, is all to me the playground of the rich in my mind. So, like, her waking up wherever she woke up in New York City, I was like, oh, she's rich because she lives in Manhattan.
Mm-mm.
But, you know, this is 2006, so it's a little different. The only time I noticed a difference between her and the other women was when she got on the subway. And at that point, I was like, go, girl. Don't waste money on a cab.
Right. Yeah. I do think there is all, you know, she is coming from like a middle class background, but also, and her dad is like helping her with the rent.
Yeah.
But she has like a chef boyfriend, and together they live together, and they don't, to collectively, they don't make that much money.
And but, she loves grilled cheese sandwiches.
It is a movie. There are things where I'm just like, okay, suspension of disbelief. All right, whatever. Like, they all look and live like they're 27, but I think she's meant to be 23.
Right.
And
she should look like more of a baby.
Right. And she, her best friend in the movie is an established artist who gets mad at Andrea for flirting with someone, and you know, it's not very like understanding of her very demanding job, but it's like, if you're in the fine art world, you more than anyone else should understand how demanding the world this yes. world is. So for you to give her a tough time, to me, is not really realistic.
Right. And like, not understanding the politics, not understanding networking, not understanding it seems so interesting to me that she, her friend, ran an art gallery.
Mm-hmm.
If she's supposed to be around 23, because
she didn't run an art gallery. Yeah. She is a fine artist who had an art show where this Christian character is present. So it must have been a prestigious event. But if you're a prestigious artist by the time you're 23, you would be cutting that character some slack, and you wouldn't be like judging her, throwing shade for getting a kiss in a corner. From, you know, if she's your best friend, it's like, it would be like, what's happening here? It wouldn't be like, you've changed.
I just thought that she was the curator for the gallery. Was she not?
No, I'm pretty sure it was, well, she was like,
the artist?
I think she were, I don't remember, but I do think, I thought that she worked at a gallery.
Right.
Yeah,
I guess that makes more sense.
And so she had set up the displays.
Yeah.
Right. Like, look at it from this way to that way.
That makes more sense.
A lot of parallels between high fashion and the fine art world. Yeah, they're almost identical in a lot of ways. They're creating this demand for supply. It's like they're almost like some of the most overpriced entities on earth, I think, lie within fashion and fine art. And
I mean, fine art is all about laundering money now.
1,000%. it absolutely is. Yeah.
Yeah. As soon as I make that illegal $100 million, Basquiat's.
New York City real estate, as well as London real estate, and then fine art is where people launder their money.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. That's why we have all those empty buildings in the middle of Manhattan.
Chinese business billionaires.
Russian oligarchs.
They love it. It's like frivolous shells. Expenditures for the uber wealthy.
Or if you look at the entire skyline of Miami, it was all just built on cocaine money from the 80s.
Mm-hmm. A lot of it now is all foreign investors. Foreign developers built that whole town.
Yeah.
That's going to be underwater in 30 years, unfortunately, for them.
But let's talk about these characters. So we've got Annie shows up at her first day at this office. We meet the wonderful Emily Blunt, who blew me away in her performance as Emily Charlton. And she, her accent was on point. Her meanness, I could not get in. Every time she said something cutting, I just like clapped at the screen. And then
that's what fashion women are like, especially from like Australia. They're like notoriously mean.
I'm just into watching people be mean to each other on screen. Mm-hmm. It's fine. Because, you know, we're very polite in real life and very nice. So it's just whatever. Vicariously, I was like, look at this workplace. I can't believe
I've had coworkers like that.
Yeah. And do you end up bonding together, or is it just always?
I mean, you definitely have. I mean, the dynamic that they had is very much like the dynamic that I had with those types of coworkers, where it's like they're annoyed by you and your like pluckiness, but then also just like do your job. But then there are moments where it's like when they have like a human, you know, there is human error and you have their back, and there is like, oh, thank you, like an acknowledgement of like, oh, there's like a commiserating, I suppose.
Sure, a little camaraderie. I mean, you're both in the trenches together, and there seems to be this weird tension between trying to strive and succeed and get to the top individually, but then also every once in a while you do have to make a sacrifice to save someone else or to like keep the whole ship from sinking.
Mm-hmm. Someone's got to get in trouble.
Somebody's got to fall on the sword.
Yeah.
So we've got Emily's character and her goal, her dream, her desire is to go to Paris later that
year. She loves fashion. She is a fashion girl. She lives, breathes, dies. It is her whole life.
Yeah, she's devoted everything. She sacrificed her whole life to this.
Yes.
And so, you know, in that, I want her to make it. Mm-hmm. I want her to achieve her goal of going to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And Annie actually rubbed me a little bit the wrong way. Like, I would never have hired her when she came in and she talked to Miranda Presley, and she says, yeah, it's either this or working at, like, writing for AutoZone.
Mm-hmm.
And that dismissive...
She was very honest and didn't know any better.
Yeah, it's like a slap in the face to people who have actually devoted their whole lives to this thing that they care about.
It's to show she's like a fish out of water. She has no idea what she's doing. She's just out of college.
Yeah.
It is pretty dismissive, yeah.
You know, it's like if I went to a restaurant, you know, you work at and they're like, so why do you want to work here? And it's like, I don't know, I like making French fries. Like, whatever, it's cool.
Well, at that point...
Food's nice. People eat it.
Either this or be homeless.
She also was like, well, I'm not going to get this job anyways, so I might as well be honest based on how I've been treated as I walked through the door.
And that's when we meet Tucci too, right? Tucci yes. comes in as Nigel, and the first thing he does is he puts a box up to her face and then points and whispers, who is this? every line out of his mouth is like another...
comedy.
Another gold. Dope roast joke.
Can you guess what my favorite line in the whole movie is?
No.
My favorite line is when Stanley is giving her that pep talk and he's like, wake up, six. Oh. They keep calling her fat because she's size six.
That was crazy to me.
So more funny.
Slender girl, I was like, she's too real yeah. thin.
No, so that's like, it's so true. Whenever I would go into the fashion building when I was in college, if someone was wearing sweats, they just like kind of pull a Stanley, like whisper, did someone die? Just like, you'd have like 2 hours of sleep, but still you have to look chic.
I loved, well, the line that I wrote down a bunch of lines based on what that, and I did put in capital letters six with four exclamation points, but when he says, who is that sad little person? Are we doing a before and after piece I didn't know about?
Yes.
He's so good. We saw him at the Met walking around one time when I was with my mom, and she was like, is that the guy from Devil Wears Prada? And I was like, yep.
Yes. Best that's role.
Tucci.
Yes. So we meet.
Talk about range.
We meet him, and then we meet Miranda Presley. And you already brought up some of her admirable traits. And before, like, you know, everyone's going to talk about her as a villain when you read pieces about this. But I actually wrote down, like, her. Well, what did I like about her? And her most admirable traits to me are that she understands office power dynamics incredibly well. Like throughout the movie, we see her. She almost has like a Michael Corleone. In Godfather strategy to keep her position
a chess player.
Yeah, I mean, she's the smartest person in the room at all times. I mean, that's her best quality.
Yeah, and then her ability to juggle so many high-end commitments and obligations. Mm-hmm. Like, as she walks into the room and she talks to her personal assistants and tells them what she needs done, I was thinking, well, if I want to be a high-functioning, like, commander of industry and make this podcast really pop off, how will I be able to delegate tasks to make these things that need to happen?
I would like it very much if you turned into her character. It would be a pleasure.
Just walked into the Eat, Pray, Judge studio throwing my jacket in bag.
You mean your living room?
And there's like a college
Gabe, why are you making a mess?
Stop yelling at me.
Yeah. I need somebody to make me a dinner... reservations at Smith and Walensky.
Where's my steak?
You know, Ember would not be having any of that.
And she has a deep understanding of fashion and fashion history. So clearly...
Well, she is fashion.
I was going to say, a deep understanding, or she just actually, like, whatever comes in her head, she sort of creates and dictates what happens in the fashion world, correct?
So, I want to say that is true, but whenever another person assistant brings her like specs for mm-hmm. what the floral patterns are going to be this year, or how about we do like an Asian design this year? She's like, no, that happened 2 years ago
right.
here, or that happened 4 years floral. Ago here. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, she's definitely unquestioned for the most part during the entire film
yeah.
when it comes to that.
She's like a Wikipedia for all mm-hmm. for all of the trends in fashion for the last, you know, half century.
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed like, I mean, comparatively, the only people who seem good at their job are Miranda and Stanley Tucci's character.
Nigel, love him.
Nigel.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're the only people that, like, are good. And everyone else is an imbecile around them.
Yes, yes. And then our friend Annie, she meets Christian Thompson,
mm-hmm.
Who I'm going to call Golden Eyebrows from mm-hmm. now on.
He's a player.
Yeah, and he is a writer who she admired and read. She read his works in college, so he must be a lot older than her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking he's like 40 in real life, and she's like 23
mm-hmm.
in like the narrative of the film.
He's probably supposed to be like 35.
Yeah.
Yeah, you think. So he's definitely at least a decade to 15 years older than her.
Yeah.
Published, doing it, dismissive of her job in fashion, negging her off the bat.
Taking little pot shots at her boyfriend, who, by the way, your boy Vinny Chase is like the moral compass of this film.
Yeah, Adrien Grenier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was when he was in the thick of Entourage.
Yeah.
But he also did like the 90s rom-com, Drive Me Crazy. So he has range.
Yeah.
You know?
More of a documentarian, kind of like he's a pseudo-philanthropist, but...
Oh, in real life?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've never seen him act.
Just in Entourage and this.
Right, right. I didn't watch Entourage, so...
I don't know how much acting was done there, but it was interesting.
Yeah, he was like, you know, the sweet fuck boy. Or like, oh, he loves women. But he's the sweetheart of the gang.
Okay,
in
yeah.
Entourage.
The moral compass of the gang? Or the sort of blank...
He's the star that's on the rise, basically. So he's supporting his friends and
yeah.
kind of creating a career.
He's the Leo. Leo DiCaprio.
Yeah, something like that. But in this movie, he's like a sort of a more subtle, but he is kind of like the moral compass.
He's just like the nice boyfriend.
Yeah.
The nice college sweetheart.
The dutiful boyfriend.
Yeah, who's like annoyed that Annie is working late. And, you know, a part of me was like, the older I am watching the movie, I'm like, oh, you're actually being quite unfair to her. Like, you're getting mad at her for doing her job.
I feel like he was more mad at her kind of selling out to this world more so than her actually doing her job. I just think he's like, you didn't really care about any of this stuff, and now it's like your entire life. So like, I feel like if it was something she was passionate about.
Are you supposed to not care about the job that you're doing? I feel like he said like, oh, at least have integrity. But it's like, what she was doing was having integrity in her job.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on both sides about this. I think that if she had said, I really love fashion now, and I want to be the best at this job.
Well, she just learned to appreciate. She didn't know anything about fashion before she had the job.
Yeah. Oh, I don't mean at the beginning. I mean halfway through. Like, what he saw of her was the complaining.
Like, yeah.
He didn't see her love of it.
Yeah.
You know, because she would come home and complain about it, and then have her phone ring, and it would disrupt that time. And like, I'm like, being an artist, I get being on call, you know, so I was never like,
but also like, it's different because you're working for someone, you know. It's not like, oh, you're choosing this gig over spending time with me. It's like, no, you work for someone else. You don't get to dictate the terms. Like, I feel like, yeah, when I was still working in costume design, I had friends that reacted the same way, but it's like, how can you be mad at me? I'm not in control of my work schedule.
That's right. And that's where I felt like sometimes it was more communication that was needed. Like whenever I watched them have tension, I was like, oh, you all just need to talk,
mm-hmm.
you know, rather than it be.
But also they're young. They're supposed to be 23.
Right, right, right. You know, but I could, I'd be like, hey, look, I'm out of town. I'm going to Paris and there's nothing I can do about that. I get back in a week. And when I get back, we'll have dinner.
Mm-hmm.
We'll pen in 45 minutes of QT.
Mm-hmm.
A little quality time.
I'm going to jump forward a little bit. Did they end up together? Or because he says that there's, it's possible that they can end up in Boston, or like that there's grilled cheeses in Boston, I think was the line. But I couldn't tell whether they reconciled, and she obviously took the job.
Yeah.
So, no. Right?
Up for interpretation.
I think if you live in New York, why would you move to Boston?
I can't
just
imagine.
It feels like a downgrade. Sorry to all of our Boston listeners.
Well, I mean, if you have like a journalism job, yeah, I think it's one of those things where either industry, you know, you can be a successful chef in Boston, you can be a successful journalist in Boston.
That's right.
But I feel like you could be better at both of those, or like you'd have more opportunities in both of those fields, definitely in New York. So it seems strange to go to Boston to run a restaurant.
Well,
or to
sous
chef, sorry.
Yeah, I guess if that's your best job offer
right.
at the time.
And he said he loved the restaurant.
Yeah.
He knew about it. So
the Oak Room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds prestigious.
I know. Anytime.
It's working.
Yeah. I'm like, ooh, at the Oak Room, I feel like I could get like a nice Malbec there and like a bone-in porterhouse, you know?
Yeah. They're by nature, they
dry
all have bones in them.
Dry rubs, aged.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I love the buzzwords.
Yeah.
Keep them going.
Uh-huh. Cooked in butter with some nice garnish.
That's right, garnish. I was just curious because I couldn't tell what happened there. It seems like they wanted to reconcile. I felt like when he said that there's grilled cheeses, then they would move. But ultimately,
I mean,
I think Blair's right. Just up for interpretation. Who knows? Crazy kids. They've got their whole lives ahead of them.
Right, exactly. Yeah, this was a blimp.
Yeah. Yeah, don't lock it. Don't lock it in at 23. You know, he's moving away. He's going to grow, sow some oats. She's going to grow, sow some oats. Maybe she goes on there's a conference she's got to go to, a journalist conference, and it's in Boston, and they meet up, and it's like 2 days they
college
spend together.
College sweethearts.
Did you just write the sequel right now?
Yeah. No big deal, you know? Yeah. They don't have to.
You worry about yourselves at that age.
Exactly.
You take care of number one.
Well, I think when you're straight out of college, it's like, oh, well, I have to establish my life, and you don't necessarily fit into it right now, but now that we're settled, we can be together again. Like, my roommate from a year ago, that was her situation where she, like, broke up with her boyfriend for a year, but then they ended up back together once they, like, were settled in New York.
Yeah, because do you really want to be with – when someone is not able to be with someone else, like – this whole time that she's working at the Runway magazine, I mean, she's just a frazzled, stressed out mess who's constantly answering phones.
Yeah.
Like there's no space in her life to actually be.
And it's like your first encounter with like adult expectations and adult responsibility. You know, I think especially if you just have only known, like, oh, your college boyfriend, your college friend group, it's like, oh, you need to go out of that in order to really know what you want.
And I feel like it's okay for the people outside of the actual two-person relationship. Like, the friends were more supportive of her, kind of. They were, you know, they'd mess with her a little bit, but they...
Yeah,
they
the
didn't
male
really
friend
have as, yeah,
was they, supportive.
Exactly. They didn't have as much at stake. I didn't fault Grenier's character for being, like... I think he saw her quality of life downgrade... And then directly affects their quality of life together.
But I also think it just like neglects big picture where it's, you know, it's like this is just for a year and for you to get so upset, I thought was unfair.
Well,
now that I watched it this time, you know, before it's just like, oh, bummer, you missed his birthday.
But would it have been different if she was doing this? Like she was working the same amount of hours and had the same sort of... job requirements. If she was in a field that she actually loved, I wonder. I'm curious to see whether he would have been more supportive. I feel like he might have been, or he would have been.
Like to piggyback on that, I was thinking, what if you were with a partner who wanted to be a doctor, and it's like 4 years.
Yeah, you would support that person.
And then they have the residency, and in the residency, you're on call 24 hours a day, or like for two.
It would
days
be a
straight.
Strain, but I feel like you have to like understand that that's what they want, and you would help them build their life. For you know, this job would lead to a journalism job, so it's like to me, it seemed unfair of him.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of that is again, you brought up it's 23, but it's also like wow, if they had like older mentors, or if they had someone to say, look, this is going to be really hard for a year. Figure out your relationship expectations now so right. that you're not hurt about it later on. Also, who gives a fuck about birthdays?
Nobody.
Right. a 23-year-old, I guess.
I'm like, get out of here. Your last birthday that matters is 21.
Oh, after I don't even know if he cared that rap. Much. He was just mopey in general.
Yeah.
My birthday.
Right. He honestly...
He actually said, he goes, what do I... He's like, I don't care about my birthday. What was I? What am I, five?
He could have been a lot better. He could have been a lot worse is what I mean. Like, I would see a more toxic male representation of this as, like, somebody, like, crying and whining about, like...
I mean, I understand why... And,
like, hitting walls or something.
In terms of, like, a screenplay or a story, I get why it is in there. Just, you know, you got to create conflict in order to move the character forward. But, yeah, I think, at least I'm thinking about the book, if her relationship was deteriorating. Like, I actually think in the book she, like, fully cheated on him.
Oh. With our boy, Golden Eyebrows.
Yeah, Golden Eyebrows.
He's got that lion mane of blonde hair. Cloth. Tousled. And he's always rocking a scarf.
Yeah.
Mature.
Yeah. It was much more of a... think a sleazy dynamic.
Yeah,
and more like dark. The book was a lot more dark.
Yeah they really, I mean, they painted it really innocently in this film, where, you know, her and Adrian have already broken up when she hooks up with Golden Eyebrows, so it's not a big deal that mm-hmm. It's a no fault one night stand.
Mm-hmm. She was much more depressed in the book. Like, the Anne Hathaway character was definitely very, like, plucky, upbeat, earnest. Oh, just...
What I like is how this was not a rom-com.
No.
I like that the relationship...
it's a dramedy.
...is very much low on the totem pole of, like, sort of real issues in this film.
It's like an innocent bystander.
Yeah, the meat of this movie, the red meat, the center of that bone-in Smith and Wolensky porterhouse is the relationship between Miranda and Annie.
Yeah. I also, yeah, I love that because I just feel like, at least in terms of my personal experiences, romance is just so kind of like the D story. It's like not even a part of the plot, you know? It's just kind of like, that's like the music surrounding the main story. Yeah. It's like, I feel like, especially now in our culture, if you're doing something creative, like that is what you're focusing on.
Yeah, it's the side dish.
Yeah. I feel like it was there to accentuate the tension in her, like, day-to-day work life, just to show, like, oh, this is happening and this is suffering now because of this, as well as all these other things are suffering because of your job.
Yeah, I do think it's, like, a little annoying when stories are just like, oh, women are trying to, you know, they just want a boyfriend. Oh, why can't I find a boyfriend? I'm just staring at my phone on a Friday night. When will he call me?
But there's a lot of, like, gender role reversal in this film. I mean, like, the most powerful character is a woman, and like Vince, whatever his character's name was, Nick?
Nick? God, I think so. Adrian Grenier.
Yeah. He plays a role that was mostly relegated to women. Like the again, to use your term, the dutiful.
Yeah, you know, doting.
Yeah, the doting, loving partner.
You know, my favorite show growing up was Married with Children because of Marcy Darcy. Mm-hmm. And she was the next door neighbor who was the go-getter, hyper-feminist lawyer. And she had a husband for the first two seasons who was kind of the wimpy next door neighbor who Al would commiserate with. And then she divorces him and she marries this model named Jefferson Darcy. And he was a stay-at-home husband, and the show played it for laughs. But watching this growing up, he was the first example of a positive male role model.
Wow. For me,
because it was like, oh, you don't have to get it. Like,
don't have to be the provider.
Yeah, you don't have to have a job even. Like, like when you're a little kid and people are like, what do you want to do? Like, little boys are like, I'm going to be a fireman. I'm going to be an army man. And
Ali Wong's last hour was about that. It's just like, yeah, my husband's not upset. Is anyone upset over free money?
Yeah, no, like I would love to somebody to provide for me so I could just spend all the time reviewing films for you, dear listener, here on Eat, Pray, Judge. So
yeah. Also, he was a chef. It's like, oh, a chef's hours. You're working 6 days a week and you're working late, and if you're really like going for it.
Yeah, he seemed really well adjusted. Like every chef that I've met.
It's like, those are both incredibly difficult careers and hours, especially if you're a young person. I'm like shocked.
Yeah, he should have been banging smack with Anthony Bourdain at this time, just looking like a total dirtbag covered in stains.
Reading Kitchen Confidential. Where are your tattoos?
Yeah, let's be honest. This relationship never would have lasted based on their hours. So it's okay. Suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, chefs are just like terrible sailors' mouths. Like, he didn't have any colorful language.
He wasn't even a chef. He was a sous chef. He was promoted to sous chef at one point, but he was in the trenches.
Yeah. Line cook.
Yeah. A glorified line cook at that point. Mm. But yeah, so that's not an easy industry to deal with. The hours are awful, and the work is physically demanding on top of being...
Ultimately it's her story, but like, if there was a more nuanced take, like, I feel like they would be discussing I've been at work, or like,
that's the mark of a good movie, though. It's like, there's enough compelling character stories where you could take it in different directions, but I mean, they made it not one-dimensional, which was great.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously the acting as well, which was pretty incredible, especially if the top
there
two.
Were no flat characters.
No. He was the flattest, I feel like, Grenier's character.
I think he's the one that I would, if we had to edit.
Well, maybe it was him as an actor, because I feel like that is his style, if you look at all of...
Yeah, he's kind of...
Very, just kind of...
Droopy.
Yeah.
Couldn't think of a better adjective.
My favorite...
like a human basset hound.
Yes. My favorite speech in this was the cerulean blue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I feel like that, it's famous, maybe.
I've definitely done that for an audition once.
Really?
It's like a very popular audition monologue.
Okay. Yeah. What a great way to break somebody down by discussing how they fit into history and how, like...
And you can play it so many different ways based on, like, vocal intonation. And you could tell she's, like, focused on the dress, but she's also just kind of, like, railing into her, but in a very, like, calm, collected way.
You win arguments with facts, right? So there wasn't really an argument. It was just like a one-sided...
rhetorical.
Yeah.
No, that wasn't a question.
And it makes me think of the way that names also trickle down through class. So like a name will start...
Brittany.
Yeah, and that'll be like a name that wealthy, wealthy people will name their child. And then that, over time, it becomes like a middle-class name. And then it ends up a couple years later... as the name of the lowest class of people in a society. So in the same way, you see, I feel like that was like a Malcolm Gladwell book chapter or from Freakonomics, but in the same way, like, to see how fashion trends also trickle down.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, by the time the teens
casual
are getting
it. Casual corner that you drag that out of. Your lumpy sweater.
Oh, so good. What else? The most stressful scene in the movie for me was when Annie goes out to eat with her dad.
Mm.
And she has to keep answering the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Miranda is stuck in hurricane weather in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And that was played to such great comic effect, too, yes. When you see the cartoon.
Yeah, show don't tell jokes. I think that's what's missing from a lot of, like, contemporary comedic films, is, like, you're not really using... It's all very, like, dialogue heavy, and it's not very visual heavy. Like, there should be a lot of visual jokes.
Yes. Yeah, and this movie visually is appealing.
It's a perfect screenplay.
Yeah, and then the mission.
The mission?
She's going to get fired if she does not perform the impossible task of getting an unpublished Harry Potter book to Miranda.
Impossible.
To like a lesser degree, I've been like given those types of jobs before where it's just like, well, we need this on set in 10 minutes. And really making you feel like if you don't get it there in 10 minutes when you're like an hour away, you're going to be fired.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of stuff like that.
This is like a task that the gods of Olympus would have given to Hercules. You know, it's like a trial that he had to pass. Like,
or like you're told to get one thing, but it's just like, why didn't you get multiples? How could you not think that we would need a duplicate of this?
I mean, in an odd way, it almost seems like she was building her up because she was like, you can do anything, right?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Well, if you can rise to the challenge right. and you succeed,
yeah.
you have now proven that you can like survive in this rarefied right. air.
I know. I like how she never fired her. I was just like, well, you can do anything. Like, I'm going to give you this challenge, and if you fail this challenge, this is your lifeline, Annie. I keep calling her Annie. It's Aunt Andrea.
Andy, yeah.
Oh, was it Andy?
Or... But it's okay. You can get away with it.
Well, it's Anne Hathaway. So. And then, yeah, Andy, Andrea.
Andrea, Andy.
Andrea.
Sax.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry about that, everybody. I'm known on this podcast for mispronouncing the names of the characters and actors.
In this Miranda case, Priestley. You got the actor's name right, though.
Yeah.
So it's okay.
Yeah, we'll be fine.
I think my favorite scene was the scene in Paris, which was actually not filmed in Paris because they said it was too expensive to fly Meryl Streep to Paris to film mm-hmm. for 2 days. So her scenes were shot here. The entire Paris hotel room scene where she exposes the fact that she's getting divorced and she kind of touches
her
on
humanity.
The double standard. Yeah, sort of. As human as she's going to possibly be, like misty-eyed.
Yeah.
But still only like, you know, single-minded in career. Like, I mean, she feels bad for her kids, obviously, the twins.
She's a good mom.
She's a good mom. Or she cares. She loves them.
Mm-hmm. I respect her in this.
Well, yeah. Also, you have to consider, like, who she's surrounded by. Like, this is technically your subordinate. You're not exactly going to gab with your subordinate.
Yeah, you're not going to text the pages for sex. You're not going to share your life and feelings with your subordinate. When Annie yeah. says... Andy says, what else do you want from me? And she's like, yeah, I want you to do your job. Like yeah. that is like 100% what,
and not even with that inflection,
HR, I'd be like, yeah,
you know, there was no any animosity. She was just like, I want you to do your job.
Right.
You know,
I don't even think she has people that she dishes this kind or has these kind of discussions with. I think that's probably the closest she gets to like human interaction or like a voice of empathy.
Yeah, I do wonder for like, you know, it kind of reminds me of Succession or just like who are the people that very powerful people confide in?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she does fall in love. She does date, you know, she has had multiple husbands and same with like the real.
Anna Winter.
Yeah, the real Anna Winter. So it's like there are people that you are vulnerable to and are human to. So I'm just curious, like, how someone like that decides who
you
to
get
open
a spiritual
up to.
Advisor. You get like an Oprah, you know, and the Oprah invites you over to dinner where you meet a high-end financier who mm-hmm. doesn't care about your field, really, or doesn't have like a monetary incentive.
Yeah. Well, I guess you would just really keep it separate. I think that's a takeaway yeah. that I'm. Now assessing, where it's just like, yeah, you would never talk about your personal life to your assistant. And
I think most people do, but then it just becomes sticky and icky,
right?
Well,
because then it's like, then she would probably expect to share her personal life with mm-hmm. the Anna Wintour character,
and that can be used against her later, because
right?
It's a hierarchical relationship.
You expect me to bend to your humanity? You're my employee.
She actually mentions it in the guy, like in the sense that she was telling her that they had to talk to her publicist to figure out how to yeah. keep it out of the paper, like minimize its exposure to the, you know.
Yeah,
which is interesting. So it's all. I mean, still again,
that was their most personal conversation.
Yeah,
or like,
by far.
In the car when she was like, "You're a lot like me."
That's true.
And then when you do reveal who you really are, somebody might write a book about you, like The Devil Wears Prada.
Right. They've even made her look like Anna Wintour, kind of.
Yeah.
Oh, like the hair color. I mean, just like the.
I mean,
general
it's very
aesthetic.
Clear. It wasn't.
Yeah. There was no.
The legend.
Yeah, yeah. I and then when she quits. I thought about how like these people who she's now able to be friendly or affectionate with her former coworkers because they don't have that relationship anymore. You know, they don't have that worker relationship, but these people who are stuck in that world can't show more than a glimmer of emotion
mm-hmm.
towards her. And it just made me think about like, you know, you might be tight with people when you're at work with them, but the minute that you leave, it's like there's no reason for you to interact anymore.
Yeah.
And like they, because I found, I thought that she left in a good place, but I felt bad for everybody that was still in fashion. Because, like, they were still prisoners to the thing.
Well, they actually, the difference is they actually love it.
Right.
You know, like, if I actually loved costume design like I thought I did, I would have stayed in it. Right. But I realized when I worked in it that I didn't. But, yeah, that's ultimately the difference. It's like, if it's your true passion in the same way, like, oh, well, comedy is, like, our true passion where it is a slog and it is very challenging. But if you actually truly love it, then you would.
Yeah. So when I meet people that like left and now live in you know, St. Louis or whatever, and they've got kids and they're not doing comedy
because they didn't actually love it.
Yeah, it's fine
and that's totally valid. It's like, oh well, you should be doing something else.
Yeah.
I as far as her quitting scene, I would have loved to see her actually quit face to face in this one. I normally wouldn't care, but I felt like that discussion would have been very interesting, because I would have loved to see what the reaction would have been and if there was any sort of bartering or if there was any attempt on her Priestley's end to like keep her. I was just curious to see what would happen there, because she obviously valued her as an employee more so than anybody. She's Emily, new Emily or whatever.
I love that she gave her a reference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like game respect game.
Yeah. If you don't hire her, you're an idiot.
I thought that would be the quote, actually, that you'd like.
Oh, yeah.
These people indirectly compliment somebody without ever doing it to their face. I mean, like when, you know, the last scene where she gives her clothes to real Emily.
Mm-hmm.
And Emily doesn't even say thank you.
Yeah,
she just acknowledges, I'll send someone over to pick them up, hangs up. You have huge shoes to fill. So, like, mm-hmm. They can't even compliment
Which
each other.
Which is a double entendre.
Yeah, that's, there you go.
It's really funny.
Because she had big feet.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. 8.5.
What up, 6, with your 8.5? You look like a L.
Yeah. No, wait. Oh, my God.
That would be more like a skinny person.
It's true.
But this movie, a lot of body shaming.
Yeah,
it's a body
fashion
shaming.
Industry, well, in general.
I mean, it's not a moral industry.
No.
No.
Very self-important and mean.
I think it would be weird to impose more. I mean, it'd be nice to impose workers' rights on it, but why impose morals on something that is ultimately
superficial? When I took a fashion drawing class when I was 16, they said the legs were... It's not normal proportions. It's like the legs are half the body. So, you know, usually, you know, it's like in 8 quarters, and I forget the actual breakdown, but it's like the legs are not supposed to be half. And so I started bringing that in when I was doing like my art school portfolio, and it was always pointed out to me when I would do figure drawing.
They were like you have all these
please
pony legs?
Stop, you clearly have a fashion background, because you keep drawing fashion proportions.
Yeah. I thought maybe you were trying to bring realistic drawings to your fashion world, and they would be like, don't do that.
Legs are longer, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Half the body in a fashion model.
I'm going to start drawing like that and see how it looks.
Yeah, tiny little torsos, big heads, and just big legs, long legs.
Yeah.
This is actually the most expensive costume budget in movie history. It would have been the most expensive, except a lot of designers obviously donated the clothes to get in, but it would have been by far, far and away the most expensive movie costume budget.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure a lot of the stuff was loaned. When I worked in costume design, I'm forgetting the actual term, but you essentially send out, not a press release, I'm forgetting what it's called, but essentially you reach out to all these designers. When I worked on Mike Birbiglia's Don't Think Twice, it was such a small crew. I actually, you know, I'm like, oh, here are all the indie designers that kind of match the mood board. So I honestly, it's so great when you work in, that's what I miss the most working in costumes, is like you never buy clothes. Just because, and I would like pick the designers that we would get like freebies from and send these like releases to, and they would just like send you stuff because it's product placement.
Yeah, tons of product placement in this. Starbucks.
That's
must
what
have,
I was talking about. Product placement.
They must have
free
gotten,
advertising.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. There were so many products in this movie that were seamlessly dropped in. Almonds.
Yeah, with all couture, it's always loaned. you know?
Yeah.
It's just the costume designers having relationships with...
Donatella Versace, just yeah. the name even.
I would always go... I remember one time I was working on a film where it was like... We were grabbing stuff during fashion week, so I was watching like these designers, you know, doing fittings with models, and I'd walk in and they'd just hand me this big bag of stuff, or just like, and it is exactly like it is in the movie. It's just like all these very, you know, toothpick models and all the fashion girls and the click click click.
Yeah.
And you're running around and you have all these big bags. That's the crazy thing about working in fashion costume design, is like, especially when you're on the when you're at an entry level position, there is so much gophering, but you're like, you know, you're like 120 pounds and you're schlepping like hundreds of pounds through like 100 degree heat in New York City. And, you know, a lot of times you have to get on the subway because it's faster. And, you know, I think I developed really bad back problems, and you're really? Like a glorified mover in a way, is like schlepping all this stuff.
Yeah,
it's so awful.
They should give you bags with wheels. You know?
I mean, you wouldn't move as fast.
Like, your nimble fingers won't work as fast, my Mm-mm. little sweatshop child.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we're running out of time, so I wanted to sort of wrap things up with final thoughts about the film. You saw this movie back when it came out, and watching it now, how does it hold up? What do you think differently?
I've seen this movie so many times, and every time I watch it, I take away something new, and I feel like there's always more nuances that I pick up on, or like I relate to something in a different way, or like, oh, that was just a movie, that was just a story, but now I actually like see my own life in the story. And yeah, I think it's just like a perfect depiction of what it is to work in like a cutthroat creative industry like that. What else do I have to take away? Yeah, and it's just so funny. Like, I don't think it gets the credit that it deserves as a movie, especially as a comedy. Like, I know it got like a lot of critical acclaim when it first came out, but I think as like a movie that's a part of the canon, you know, something that we like really refer to in terms of, you know, people always talk about like, oh, the Coen brothers, or I don't know. I feel like this is a better movie than most of the Coen brothers movies that I've seen. I feel like any movie that is like a movie with a female protagonist that is a feminine story is always just kind of like brushed aside. Like, same with Legally Blonde, where it's just like, that's a tight fucking script, and so is this one.
We covered that.
We sure did.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's just like, yeah, these are the movies that people really connect with, but because they're feminine, they're not really taken seriously.
Well, this film passes the Bechdel test.
Hell yeah.
So I got to say, I loved Emily Blunt in this because I saw a different side of her acting. I loved Stanley Tucci in this. We've already covered films with him on the show, including Big Night, mm-hmm. which was fantastic. And he and Meryl Streep kills it.
Yes.
As well as sort of
their best roles.
The most iconic antagonists in movie history. I thought that this was things I took away from this movie were a recommitment to being excellent. And I loved the mastery that Stanley Tucci's character and Miranda's character possess, regardless of how mean they can be at times. You know, I'm not really about being polite. I'm about getting things done. And I like, at least I admire those qualities in them. So this is a great movie about, you know, what it means to be a professional at your first job.
Yeah. That was like a big thing that I took away this time watching it. It's like, oh, this is what it is. If you like come from a middle class background and you think the world is one way and you're like, you know, all bright eyed and you think, like, oh, they're going to love me. And then you enter. It's just like,
you have the luxury of a soft, supportive family.
Right.
And soft, supportive institutions that have given
the
you
the reality price. Of the adult world is much more harsh than you anticipated.
The rent has to be paid on time every month at the exact same time.
Everyone's got bills. Everyone has responsibilities. And you're just a part of it.
Why did you not pay your credit card one day? Why did you pay it one day late? You fucked up your credit forever. Why did you do that?
Don't. Thank God for those jobs that pay rent. That's the best kind of job.
Yes. Well, I'm going to give this movie out of, I'm going to give it, 8 toe rings out of 10.
Toe rings?
Yes. Yeah, I love a nice...
I noticed that little toe ring sequence.
A nice sneaky toe ring just added, inserted into the film.
Yeah. Hmm. Showed her personality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm on board with what you're saying. So it's a movie that I never, you know, would have been too interested in, even based on the fact that the actors are incredible. But I think that's what saves it. It's a very engaging script. It's a really interesting sight into a world that I don't really know much about. And I think it kind of speaks for itself as far as, like, everyone who has ever worked in or around fashion loves this movie, because I think it's like a pretty accurate depiction of what that world is and how vapid it can be. And how overworked and overstressed people are for something
how
that's
absurd it
not
is.
Curing cancer or really doing any good for most of the world. But I mean, Meryl Streep is, I mean, she's incredible. And this is definitely, I mean, just she carries the film in a way that where her scenes are so understated in a way, but like, I don't think anyone else could really have done the job she did. Stanley Tucci's always solid. I mean, we did Julie and Julia, where they're together, which is an awesome movie. And this is on par with that as far as the acting is concerned there. Anne Hathaway just does a, you know, solid job. It's just it's a well done movie, and it's tight and it's really engaging throughout. Like, it's paced really well. So I enjoyed it. I would give it, I think, 8 out of 10 Filene's Basements.
Oh,
I don't know why that popped into my head.
And Stanley Tucci has one quote that I like a lot, where, like, you know, you just brought up that you know, fashion isn't part of your world or our mm-hmm. world, but Stanley Tucci's character, he's like, look at all these artists in here. What they did is greater than art because you live your life in it.
Right.
And so, like, you know, the fact that these people are making products that everyone wears all day, that are seen all day.
I agree. I care more about what I have. I mean, like, I care more about fashion in that sense than I would fine art or mm-hmm. art that I hang in my wall.
Right. You know, I need a nice, you know, when I was a teenager wearing...
Costumes are such a big part of storytelling.
Yeah. Or the JNCO jeans I used to wear to raves. Mm-hmm. Big part of my life.
Right.
Thanks, JNCO. So, and then costumes, of course, I think about that every time Halloween rolls around.
Yeah, honestly, what you're wearing tells me a story, yeah. You know?
Uniqlo is my number, and they don't even sponsor me to say this, but Uniqlo is my fast fashion
yeah.
brand.
I just got a bunch of basics from there. They're really, it's perfect for layering, and you can look really chic for very little.
Their sweatpants and sweatshirts are awesome.
And if you're a bony dude who's got a very Japanese body,
yeah,
they are perfect.
Slender.
Finally.
No sixes.
Yeah. Like Poppy over here. I got a Toshiro Mifune body over here. Nice. Like a nice modern samurai.
Unbelievably specific body type.
A joke for three people.
Yeah. Well, people that love movies.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Uniqlo. That's it.
I'm all I wear.
Fan.
Their boxer briefs, also solid.
Mm-hmm. Breathe. They breathe.
Sure, they sure do.
So important. Well, everybody, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Eat, Pray, Judge. Blair Dawson, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram at Blair Simone or Twitter, Your Girl Blair.
That's right. And if you want to catch some live stand-up comedy, you can find me every Wednesday night at Cantina Royal at
great
9 p.m. That's right, 9 p.m. And I'm host Funhouse Comedy, which is now affiliated with the Brooklyn Comedy Collective. Whoop,
whoop. I'm doing my half hour there December 6th.
Yes, people, come out December 6th to see Blair Dawson's half hour at Cantina Royal. What time?
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock. Sammy, anything for us this week?
No, I'm just looking forward to the next episode.
Yeah.
We'll be posting shortly.
All right, everybody, enjoy the holiday season. See you soon. We love you. Well, we're probably not going to see you soon, but listen to us again. Rate, review, and subscribe. Peace. Sitting on the shoulders, but that's way too high. Let's try not to step on the children. The news cameras filming this walking project building. Now that's selling like right around the toes, and the crackheads beg at about the lower leg. This crooked pole leads.